Pseudopod, episode 95, June 20th, 2008. This week's story, No Tomorrows, by Steve Cooper. Hi, welcome to Pseudopod, the weekly horror podcast. I'm your host, Alistair Stewart, and this week's story comes to us from English author Steve Cooper. Steve's a programmer, a devourer of knowledge in all its forms, and spins a pretty mean pair of flame sticks to boot. This is Steve's first appearance here, although his work has appeared previously in Hub magazine. As for your narrator, well, the less said about him, the better. So, take a little time for yourself. Take a lot, in fact. Why not take it all? Because I have a story for you, and I promise you, it's true. Six months ago, it was all sugar and no shit. 6 months ago, in a private Istanbul club called İmşi, I'd snorted coke out of the shallow belly button of an ex-Soviet farmer's girl. Reared on Georgian corn, marinated in Belarusian vodka, garnished in best Turkish blow. Say what you want about the Eastern Orthodox Church, the College of Bishops really knows how to throw a party. The fat commission on that job, though, was running low, and now I was in Leeds, in a filthy hole of a club called Tiggers, leaning back against the bar with a little plastic bottle of water and watching the crowd. The boys were thin, hungry jackals, and the girls were glittering, animated sausage meat. The place was slaughterhouse romantic. I'd come to meet a man on borrowed time. Horton had been borrowing time since 1673, and I had come to loan him a little more. I caught sight of Horton bumping through the dancers out on the black dance floor. He was moving them roughly out of his path, jerking them by their collars or shoving them by the small of their backs. And yet no one turned to stop him. Each dancer assumed they'd slipped on a spilled drink, or had a few too many. In Horton's wake, a couple of lads had even started to grapple, each assuming the other had pushed him. No one really noticed Horton anymore, poor bastard. "Horton, how's tricks?" I asked. "Old Father Time kicks me in the ballsack as usual, infant. Drink?" "Yeah, sure, great, mine's a cider." He turned and walked over to a table. I watched as he gently pushed one of the couple sitting there. The boy seemed to decide it was time to dance. The girl seemed unenthusiastic, until Horton tugged her earlobe in the direction of the dance floor. She smiled and took the boy's hand, and they moved out to dance. Horton sat, and one by one, he threw their drinks against a wall. I sat down with him, and passed him the cider. He necked half of it, then set it down. He pulled out a packet of cigarettes and lit two, offered me one. "Can't," I said, "smoking ban, bouncers will punt me out." "Fuck that, it improves the air quality," said Horton. He waved the cigarette around as if to demonstrate something. "I remember Cromwell banning incense in church. Fucking disaster. You know why they use incense in church, mate?" I shrugged. "Why?" "Because a church without incense smells like human beings, Ethan." "Smoke, you bastard, things will smell better." I sniffed. He was right. Before the ban, this place would have smelled of tobacco. Now it was pheromonal fresh sweat, on top of old body odour, and below it, cutting through unmistakably, the smell of piss. He smiled and offered me the cigarette again. I accepted. "So have you got for me?" he asked. "Dangerous one. Well, not for you, I think. A murderer." "Oh, God's blood, Ethan, a murderer? Who the fuck do you think I am? The incarnation of the justice of the Lord of fucking hosts? I think you'll like this one. He's a natural." At that, Horton seemed to calm a little. "Right. Right. So he's killed before?" He considered for a few moments. "How many kills?" "8 I know of. Probably a load more." Horton smiled like a miser dreaming of gold. 8 Shit. That's great." I knew that'd get him. By natural, I meant a natural carnivore. My family always had a talent for seeing strangeness in people. Not psychological insight, we can literally see it. The shapes and colours of strangeness. When I was a boy living in Istanbul, I would walk the streets with my sister. We would try to guess people's stories from the colours and shapes we could see inside their skins. We learned the secrets of our neighbourhood before all the adults. We saw shadows around the mouth of Rafet, who sweet-talked tourist girls, and second-hand purple stains on the knuckles of Adam, who left them beaten and robbed in unfamiliar alleys, and the mirror sheen on the eyes of Ibrahim, the plumber, who paid women for photographs. It scared the crap out of me, but I loved it. It was like having a free pass to a circus freak show. Scared the shit out of my sister, though. The most unsettling person we ever saw was Mr. Gerses, who built hotels on the outskirts of Istanbul. We saw eyes and mouths moving under his skin. Freaked the crap out of us. Every time we saw him, there were more mouths screaming without sound, and more eyes looking for a way out through the skin. Eventually, they found a stack of corpses in the foundations in one of his building sites, and we understood whose eyes and mouths they were. Many years later, I told Horton about Mr. Gerses, a natural Ethan, a natural carnivore, building up a stash of life inside his skin. I bet he was successful before they caught him. He was. Naturals tend to be like that. They take a life and their lives get bigger, you know? More consequential. Successful. Heavier. I nodded. What about you then? When I take, I can make it last. Stretch it out over years. Beats the shit out of pentapeptides. That's why I'm here today. I mean, you're not a natural. I learned it from a monograph. Prithyrches Empiricon. Who says there's nothing worth learning in books? And he showed me his teeth in a hyena smile. Horton and I jumped into my car and we drove. So, Ethan, who's the natural? You know Falkirk? Falkirk, one of Belter's thugs. Nah, Belter's dead. Falkirk took over a few years back, taking it up a notch too, looking to take over everything between here and Manchester. Shit, times change. Anyway, what about Falkirk? He killed Jenny Stranton. Stranton's granddaughter? Jesus, Horton said, looking shocked. I guess Stranton found out. Yeah, of course, Stranton's putting the word out. Anyone takes out Falkirk, Stranton's going to be grateful. How grateful? Grateful enough. We'll go halves on the money. Will we? He asked, looking wry. I think I can get to him myself. No, you can't. We're crashing a meeting in Turkey. You'll need help getting there, a translator. Shit, you can't even get a seat on a plane on your own. You'll need my help to get close. We pulled up outside my flat. Come on in. You look like you could do with a shower. Then we'll figure out how to suck the tomorrows out of this guy. Let me tell you something about Stranton, the author of our murderous little escapade. Stranton was the nicest man I have ever met. He was nearly 70 and could have made a decent living as a character actor on TV, filling parts like loving grandfather and kindly old gent. Of course, he sat at the head of an organisation that distributed around 40 kilos of crystal meth in Manchester and Bradford every week. But somehow you overlooked that because he was just so goddamn jolly. Except last time I saw him, he had not been jolly. He brought me into his living room at about 3 PM. A cream tea was laid out, waiting. He offered me a seat and poured. "Scone, Ethan," he waved towards the silver stand. "Thank you, Mr. Stranton. I will. My wife's most recent batch," he said as I split the cake. "She's not feeling herself right now, though." "Oh, I'm sorry to hear about that, Mr. S. Anything serious?" "Yes, Ethan. I'm afraid so." He paused to lift the milk jug and silently offered to pour. I nodded. "Yes, Ethan. Not so well. You see, our granddaughter, Jenny, she's been killed." I said nothing for a moment. Then, "My sincerest condolences, sir." "Thank you, Ethan. Thank you. I must confess, it's why I asked you to come. Sugar?" I shook my head. "What can I do for you, Mr. S?" "Some good friends in the constabulary have let me know the man responsible is planning a trip to Turkey soon." "Home ground for you, eh?" "Yes, sir." "Yes. Well, I want to make sure he doesn't re-enter the country. We know he'll be meeting with some of Bishop Kushku's men. I thought you might like to get in touch with your friend, Mr. Horton." Horton was peering at my bag as I queued to check in. "You haven't got any fluids, have you, Ethan?" he asked. "What?" "Fluids, shampoo and stuff, in your hand luggage." "No, Horton. Why?" "That sign over there, no fluids." "No, Horton, I'm not going to try to smuggle shampoo into Turkey. If I needed to smuggle shampoo, I'd give it to my invisible wizard friend. He could hide it under the key of crystal meth he's carrying." I shrugged the bag to a more comfortable position. "Does the sign say anything about wizards carrying 40 grand bags of Tina?" He looked. No, it doesn't." "Well then, we should be all right, shouldn't we?" He ignored me and wandered off to steal a book from W.H. Smith's. I think, like me, he recognised it was going to be a long flight. We arrived in Istanbul as the sun was rising over the Black Sea. As we coached into the city, I fell into a reverie. This was the world I had grown up in. My father was Turkish and brought his English wife here in 69. He travelled a lot on business. Mum stayed at home and raised my sister and me. We grew up as Turks. I used to chase her around the streets of Istanbul, and we would come home and eat a lanjik for dinner and tandir lamb on feast days. And after the lamb, we would go to the flat rooftop of our house and watch fireworks over the Bosporus. Then, Dad got caught carrying AIP heroin through to Bulgaria, and we realised what all that travel was about, and that was the end of Turkey. As soon as my dad was put away, Mum packed up and moved us back to Blighty. My sister moved back here, years ago now. She became a vice cop, of all things. We checked into the Hotel Anatolia, a cheap stack of cell-like rooms with bad service. Horton was going to need supplies, he'd said, for the tyke. I'm going to need some bits and pieces to do my work. So, he'd grabbed a piece of hotel stationery and written a list, which was like a crazy concert rider. The gnomon of a sundial, a cup of beaten copper, 6 AA batteries, an ounce of mercury, salt, a piece of sulphur as big as a man's eye, and a ham sandwich. I took a bus into the centre of old Istanbul, not the busy, modern new parts of town, which have all the sparkling charisma of Croydon in October, but the old city, where you found catacombs and markets which had been meeting since before Mashlama besieged the city. It was a mess of trails through a jungle of bead curtains and tobacco smoke. There was gold brick and dog shit beneath my feet, sapphire sky and onion-crowned minarets above. I plugged in my iPod and maxed the volume. I let my feet take me wherever I wanted. Some of the places were the same. Some had changed. Still, the layout was there, buried in my memory and instinct. I walked the streets randomly, unconsciously, taking automatic turns like a drunk stumbling home. Each street was unfamiliar, but patterned after memories I'd carried since infancy. I didn't know where I was, but I was not lost. In stuttering Turkish, I asked an old woman tending a stall where I could find mercury. "Merke?" I asked. She nodded, held up a splayed hand telling me to wait for 5 minutes. Then, she pulled out a miniature black mobile phone, dialed, and whispered into it like she was spilling state secrets. She closed the phone and offered me a seat. "Stay," she said. "My son will be here soon." As I sat, she lifted a box of baklava, a sweet I hadn't eaten since my childhood. She smiled as I took a piece, revealing black teeth and empty gums. We waited for her son, and when he turned up in a white lab coat, he sold me an unopened box of thermometers. I guessed he'd just stolen it from a hospital, but I said nothing. I just paid and left. The rest of the pieces I found easily enough, except the ham sandwich. Istanbul can be like that. We found the church in the Fener district. Inside, the back of the church was divided from the front by a great golden wall, covered in pictures of the saints. I looked at Horton. Apparently, Falkirk will be behind the, big wall. Iconostasis, Ethan. He looked at me, squinting back at him, and then tilted his head. "You don't know Greek?" "No. What are they teaching kids in schools these days? Ketneset, Ketipsi, Ilklaturus, Tokofali, Menan, Tarastio, Doniti, Esi, Hambari. "What does that mean?" I asked. "Just lamenting the standards of education nowadays. Let's get in." He walked up to the wall in which were set 3 equally spaced doors. He opened up the one on the left, which was guarded by a giant painting of the Archangel Gabriel, and disappeared from sight. I followed. Inside was the inner sanctum, a great stone altar sat in the centre with a huge copy of the Gospels on top, open to the Gospel of Luke. "Come, Ethan," said Horton, "let us recline at table in the kingdom of God." "The fuck?" He shook his head in disgust. "Just find somewhere out of sight, sit down and shut up." 10 minutes later, we heard people moving in the nave, and the door Horton had opened earlier opened again. Falkirk came in, dressed in a pale cream suit and carrying a cheap holdall. He walked to the altar and dropped the bag next to the Bible. He turned his back, leaned against the altar and rested for a moment. Then he reached into his pocket and pulled out an automatic pistol. He checked the slide and the safety, and put it back in his jacket. Horton waited a few minutes, pausing every so often to make sure there was no noise coming from the nave. When he was convinced it was quiet enough, he began moving around Falkirk, who was sitting on the altar fiddling with his mobile. It reminded me of a film shoot. Falkirk, sitting there oblivious to the man 3 feet from him, looked like an actor determined to ignore a cameraman. Horton was circling and strewing salt from the canister of table salt round Falkirk, like a farmer sowing seeds around a scarecrow. Falkirk just didn't notice. He sat there, thumbs moving, checking his messages. I sat in the back, watching, trying to breathe as quietly as possible. Horton seemed to finish his preparations, dumping the bag and walking over to Falkirk. He took the heavy copper goblet and chipped in a little of the sulphur. Horton spoke out loud, a fluent Latin, "Ut varius semsit amit matis nonumi, enim dolor mollis est." He rested the cup on the altar and reached into a pocket, and pulled a small lotion bottle taken from the hotel. As he opened and poured it into the cup, it flashed. The mercury. "Sed tincidunt fugiat felis." From the front of the church, on the other side of the screen, I heard a voice. "Falkirk, what did you say?" It was a woman's voice. "Nothing," shouted Falkirk, right in Horton's ear. Horton winced as he recapped the bottle. "Any sign of him yet?" "No," the voice came back. "You sure you're all right in there?" "Fine, just keep your eyes peeled." Horton threw a pinch of salt from the dispenser into the cup. "Nullam vitae nulla non leo cursus placerat." He gave the cup a quick twist, shaking the contents like a man dissolving a couple of antacids. Then he used his left hand to gently open Falkirk's mouth, and Falkirk complied, like a dentist's patient. With his right hand, he poured the contents of the cup into Falkirk's mouth, and pushed the mouth closed. "In hac habitas plathia dictumst, vivamus tempus!" As Horton finished speaking, Falkirk seemed to awaken from his bovine, lolling stupor. He fixed his eyes straight on Horton, and they widened in horror. For just a few heartbeats, he did nothing but stared. Then he tried to whip his hand into his jacket. Horton grabbed his hand, forcing the gun down into the jacket, and smashed him hard in the face with the goblet. The solid cup cracked loudly against the man's teeth. "Falkirk, what the fuck's happening?" The woman's voice, then hard, rapid footsteps. Horton hit Falkirk again and again, but it didn't seem necessary. Falkirk had doubled up now, and was making a weeping, retching sound that turned my stomach. The alchemical poison was working on his insides now. The door in the iconostasis smashed open. It flashed as the gold leaf painted on the angel reflected the sun outside. Inside the doorway was the woman, waving a gun. And I recognized her. She took barely a second to assess the situation, pointed the gun straight at Horton, and fired. Three echoes fluttered like bats into the canopy of the church. The altar was sprayed with blood, and Horton looked back at her and smiled. Falkirk had stopped moving. The back of his head was missing. Horton bent down, reached into Falkirk's jacket, and casually pulled out the gun. The woman fired and fired, edging closer with every shot, but the bullets seemed to be swallowed by Horton's body and spat out, like pulled teeth, from Falkirk's. Horton turned calmly back to her, raised the gun at her face, and smirked. There was an almighty thud, and Horton slumped to the ground. The woman tracked downwards at Horton's falling body, then raised it again to point at me. I was standing behind the chronomancer, holding the arcane copper goblet like a cosh. She aimed briefly. For just a moment, I thought she was going to shoot me. Then she lowered the gun. "Ethan? Hi, sis. Long time no see." Sonia's pistol swung loose at the end of her limp arm, and she stared at me, then at the two bodies on the floor of the church. "What the hell? Ethan? What the... Who the fuck is this? Who is this prick?" She waved the gun at Horton, this time as a pointer, rather than a weapon. My eyes followed the path the bullets might take. Horton looked different. He was still alive. That was easy for me to see. He looked like he'd become more solid, somehow. The transparency, the lack of consequence that kept people from seeing him, was gone. If anything, he tugged on the eye. Under his skin, faint patches of colour were starting to move. Sonia saw it and looked like she was going to say something, but then she held her tongue, turning back towards the front of the church and started reloading her gun. "Ethan, can you shoot?" I froze. No. No, I can't. I've never shot a gun in my life. "Well, that's a fucking shame, Ethan, because we have a meeting with three armed men in, about 2 minutes, and they will not be happy to find that Falkirk has been butchered. And if I get out of this, I'll have to explain to a tribunal why Falkirk is dead, why it appears that I shot him, and why the hell there are no fucking entry wounds for the bullets. So it would be nice if you could have brought a little something to the party, except steaming great piles of shit." "Fair point, sis. Fair point," I thought for a moment. "These men, have they ever met Falkirk?" "No," she said. "This is his first trip to Turkey." "Well then," I said, picking up the holdall of money from the altar, "let's go out front and buy ourselves some meth." My sister and I were sitting in a cafeteria a few streets from the church. The booths were upholstered in sticky, bottle-green vinyl, and the tables were puke-coloured plastic. The air conditioning rattled, and for some reason, the walls were covered in Stalin-era socialist posters. The proprietor looked a little like old Uncle Joe, too, square-headed and suspicious. "Sorry about everything," I said. Sonia didn't say anything. "Look, Sonia, I'll get my money wired to me and go travelling. Want to come with? Help me spend it? Better than staying here, maybe." She looked up from her coffee. "No can do, little brother. I'm going to stay here. Try to clean up some of this mess." I nodded, then stood and picked up my bag. Uncle Joe flinched at the sudden movement. "So long, Sonia." She stood and hugged me. "Take care, little brother." I waved to her one last time, and leaving my sister behind, I went out in the street to hail a taxi. I have, of late, been thinking a lot about the future, and the fact that it remains, it seems, as far away now as it was when I was a child. Oh sure, we've had some isolated outbreaks of it, mobile phones, the internet, the arrival of good genre TV on our screens once again, but at the same time, we don't have jetpacks, we don't have lunar colonies, we don't have a cure for cancer. We're nearly at the end of the first decade of the 21st century, and things, as D. Ream should have sung, really should have got better. But with that in mind, that sense of ennui for some, and anger for others, that, as Bill Hicks once said, we should be evolving to get on the damn spaceships, some interesting questions are raised, or, more specifically, some interesting questions are changed. For example, for all the problems today, we don't have the Black Death, or the Inquisition. We don't have some diseases that were previously a death sentence. We don't have a life expectancy of 30 years, and we do have a growing understanding of what we need to do to live our lives better and longer. I look at the world now, the omnipresent internet, the constant trickle-down of technology, and I look at the late 70s when I grew up, where fridge freezers were a new innovation, where the best food came in cardboard boxes. I look at the early 90s, where mobile phones were still the sole provisor of yuppies and the rich, and now, where we alone have three outdated mobiles in the house that neither of us use anymore. 12 years. Communication has changed forever in 12 years. Imagine where it will be in 50. Imagine where transport will be, where medical care will be, where culture will be. So, couched in those terms, the question surely becomes not who wants to live forever, but who doesn't. After all, things really can only get better. All you have to do is live long enough to see it happen. Did you like this story? Did you hate it? Do you have a keyboard? Then pop along to our forums and jump into the discussions at forum.escapeartists.info or comment on the post here. Every comment is read, believe me. Pseudopod relies on your donations to pay, not feed, as I nearly said, our authors. So if you liked this story, please go to pseudopod.org and click on Feed the Pod. I promise every author is thankful for it. Pseudopod is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives license. And Pseudopod is talking to a plastic houseplant.